distance, Tessa thought, that it was hard to remember sometimes how physically small she was, how bird-like and tiny. "Sophie has a gift," she said. "She has the sight. She can see what others do not. In her old life, she often wondered if she was mad. Now she knows that she is not mad, but special. There she was only a parlour-maid, who would likely have lost her position once her looks had faded. Now she is a valued member of our household, a gifted girl with much to contribute." Charlotte leaned forward. "You look back on the life you had, Tessa, and it seems safe to you in comparison to this one. But you and your aunt were very poor, if I'm not mistaken. If you had not come to London, where would you have gone once she died? What would you have done? Would you have found yourself weeping in an alley like our Sophie?" Charlotte shook her head. "You have a power of incalculable value. You need ask nothing of anyone. You need depend on no one. You are free, and that freedom is a gift." "It is hard to think of something as a gift when you have been tormented and imprisoned for it." Charlotte shook her head. "Sophie said to me once that she was glad she had been scarred. She said that whoever loved her now would love her true self, and not her pretty face. This is your true self, Tessa. This power is who you are. Whoever loves you now, and you must also love yourself, will love the truth of you." Tessa picked up the codex and hugged it against her chest. "So you are saying I am right. This is what is real, and the life I had before was the dream." "That is correct." Gently, Charlotte patted Tessa's shoulder. Tessa almost jumped at the contact. It had been a long time, she thought, since anyone had touched her in such a motherly fashion. She thought of Aunt Harriet, and her throat hurt. "And now it is time to wake up." 9. The Enclave. "May make my heart as a millstone, set my face as a flint. Cheat and be cheated and die. Who knows? We are ashes and dust." Alfred Lord Tennyson. Maud. "Try it again," Will suggested. "Simply walk from one end of the room to the other. We'll tell you if you look convincing." Tessa sighed. Her head throbbed, as did the backs of her eyes. It was exhausting learning how to pretend to be a vampire. It had been 2 days since Lady Belcourt's visit, and Tessa had spent almost every moment since then attempting to convincingly transform herself into the vampire woman, without enormous success. She still felt as if she were sliding around on the surface of Camille's mind, unable to reach through and grasp hold of thoughts or personality. It made it difficult to know how to walk, how to talk, and what sort of expression she ought to be wearing when she met the vampires at De Quincey's party, whom, no doubt, Camille knew very well, and whom Tessa would be expected to know, too. She was in the library now, and had spent the last few hours since lunch practicing walking with Camille's odd, gliding walk, and speaking with her careful, drawling voice. Pinned at her shoulder was a jeweled brooch that one of Camille's human subjugates, a wrinkled little creature called Archer, had brought over in a trunk. There had been a dress, too, for Tessa to wear to De Quincey's, but it was much too heavy and elaborate for daytime. Tessa made do with her own new blue-and-white dress, which was bothersomely too tight in the bosom and too loose in the waist whenever she changed into Camille. Jem and Will had set up camp on one of the long tables in the back of the library, ostensibly to help and advise her, but more likely, it seemed, to mock and be amused by her consternation. "You point your feet out too much when you walk," Will went on. He was busy polishing an apple on his shirt front and appeared not to notice Tessa glaring at him. "Camille walks delicately, like a fawn in the woods, not like a duck."
"I do not walk like a duck."
"I like ducks," Jem observed diplomatically, "especially the ones in Hyde Park." He glanced sideways at Will. Both boys were sitting on the edge of the high table, their legs dangling over the side. "Remember when you tried to convince me to feed a poultry pie to the mallards in the park to see if you could breed a race of cannibal ducks? They ate it, too, Will reminisced. Bloodthirsty little beasts. Never trust a duck.
Do you mind? Tessa demanded. If you're not going to help me, you might as well both leave. I didn't let you stay here so that I could listen to you nattering on about ducks.
Your impatience, said Will, is most unladylike. He grinned at her around the apple. Perhaps Camille's vampire nature is asserting itself. His tone was playful. It was so odd, Tessa thought. Only a few days ago he had snarled at her about his parents, and later had begged her to help him hide Jem's bloody coughing, his face burning with intensity as he did so. And now he was teasing her as if she were a friend's little sister, someone whom he knew casually, perhaps thought of with affection, but for whom he had no complex feelings at all. Tessa bit her lip, and winced at the unexpected sharp pain. Camille's vampire teeth, her teeth, were ruled by an instinct she couldn't understand. They seemed to slide forward without warning or prompting, alerting her to their presence only by sudden bursts of pain as they punctured the fragile skin of her lip. She tasted blood in her mouth, her own blood, salty and hot. She pressed her fingertips to her mouth. When she drew her hand away, her fingers were spotted with red. "Leave it alone," said Will, setting down his apple and rising to his feet. "You'll find you heal very quickly." Tessa poked at her left incisor with her tongue. It was flat again, an ordinary tooth. "I don't understand what makes them come out like that."
"Hunger," said Jem.
"Were you thinking about blood?"
"No."
"Were you thinking about eating me?" Will inquired.
"No."
"No one would blame you," said Jem. "He's very annoying." Tessa sighed. "Camille is so difficult. I don't understand the first thing about her, much less being her." Jem looked at her closely. "Are you able to touch her thoughts? The way you said you could touch the thoughts of those you transformed into?"
"Not yet. I've been trying, but all I get are occasional flashes, images.
Her thoughts seem very well protected." "Well, hopefully you can break through that protection before tomorrow night," said Will, "or I wouldn't say much about our chances."
"Will," Jem chided, "don't say that."
"You're right," Will said. "I shouldn't underestimate my own skills. Should Tessa make a mess of things, I'm sure I'll be able to fight our way through the slavering vampire masses to freedom."
Jem, as was his habit, Tessa was starting to realize, simply ignored this.
"Perhaps," he said, "you can only touch the thoughts of the dead, Tessa. Perhaps most of the objects given to you by the Dark Sisters were taken from people they had murdered."
"No, I touched Jessamine's thoughts when I changed into her.
So that can't be it, thankfully. What a morbid talent that would be." Jem was looking at her with thoughtful silver eyes. Something about the intensity of his gaze made her feel almost uncomfortable.
"How clearly can you see the thoughts of the dead?
For instance, if I gave you an item that had once belonged to my father, would you know what he was thinking when he died?" It was Will's turn to look alarmed.
"James, I don't think..."
he began, but broke off as the door to the library opened and Charlotte entered the room. She wasn't alone. There were at least a dozen men following her, strangers whom Tessa had never seen before.
"The Enclave," Will whispered, and gestured for Jem and Tessa to duck behind one of the 10-foot bookcases.
They observed from their hiding place as the room filled with shadow hunters, most of them men. But Tessa saw as they filed into the room that among them were two women. She could not help staring at them, remembering what Will had said about Boadicea, that women could be warriors as well. The taller of the women, and she must have been nearly 6 feet in height, had powder-white hair wound into a crown at the back of her head. She looked as if she were well into her 60s, and her presence was regal. The second of the women was younger, with dark hair, cat-like eyes, and a secretive demeanor. The men were a more mixed group. The eldest was a tall man dressed all in gray. His hair and skin were gray as well, his face bony and aquiline, with a strong, thin nose and a sharp chin.
There were hard lines at the corners of his eyes and dark hollows under his cheekbones. His eyes were rimmed with red. Beside him stood the youngest of the group, a boy probably no more than a year older than Jem or Will. He was handsome in an angular sort of way, with sharp but regular features, tousled brown hair, and a watchful expression. Jem made a noise of surprise and displeasure. "Gabriel Lightwood," he muttered to Will under his breath. "What's he doing here? I thought he was in school in Idris." Will hadn't moved. He was staring at the brown-haired boy with his eyebrows raised, a faint smile playing about his lips. "Just don't get into a fight with him, Will," Jem added hastily. "Not here. That's all I ask."
"Rather a lot to ask, don't you think?"
Will said, without looking at Jem. Will had leaned out from behind the bookcase and was watching Charlotte as she ushered everyone toward the large table at the front of the room. She seemed to be urging everyone to settle themselves into seats around it. "Frederick Ashdown and George Penhallow here, if you please," Charlotte said. "Lillian Highsmith, if you'd sit over there by the map."
"And where is Henry?"
asked the gray-haired man with an air of brusque politeness.
"Your husband? As one of the heads of the Institute, he really ought to be here."
Charlotte hesitated for only a fraction of a second before plastering a smile onto her face.
"He's on his way, Mr. Lightwood," she said, and Tessa realized two things.
One, that the gray-haired man was most likely the father of Gabriel Lightwood, and two, that Charlotte was lying.
"He'd better be," Mr. Lightwood muttered. "An enclave meeting without the head of the Institute present. Most irregular."
He turned then, and though Will moved to duck back behind the tall bookcase, it was too late. The man's eyes narrowed.
"And who's back there, then? Come out and show yourself."
Will glanced toward Jem, who shrugged eloquently. "No point hiding till they drag us out, is there?"
"Speak for yourself," Tessa hissed. "I don't need Charlotte angry at me if we're not supposed to be in here."
"Don't work yourself into a state. There's no reason you'd have had any idea about the Enclave meeting, and Charlotte's perfectly well aware of that," Will said.
"She always knows exactly who to blame." He grinned.
"I'd turn yourself back into yourself, though, if you take my meaning. No need to give too much of a shock to their hoary old constitutions."
"Oh." For a moment Tessa had nearly forgotten she was still disguised as Camille. Hastily she went to work stripping away the transformation, and by the time the three of them stepped out from behind the bookshelves, she was her own self again.
"Will,"
Charlotte sighed on seeing him and shook her head at Tessa and Jem.
"I told you the Enclave would be meeting here at 4 o'clock.
"Did you?" Will said. "I must have forgotten that. Dreadful."
His eyes slid sideways and he grinned.
"Lo there, Gabriel."
The brown-haired boy returned Will's look with a furious glare. He had very bright green eyes, and his mouth, as he stared at Will, was hard with disgust.
"William,"
he said finally, and with some effort. He turned his gaze on Jem.
"And James, aren't you both a little young to be lurking around Enclave meetings?"
"Aren't you?" Jem said.
"I turned 18 in June," Gabriel said, leaning so far back in his chair that the front legs came off the ground. "I have every right to participate in Enclave activities now."
"How fascinating for you,"
said the white-haired woman Tessa had thought looked regal.
"So is this her, Lottie, the warlock girl you were telling us about?"
The question was directed at Charlotte, but the woman's gaze rested on Tessa.
"She doesn't look like much."
"Neither did Magnus Bane the first time I saw him," said Mr. Lightwood, bending a curious eye on Tessa. "Let's have it, then. Show us what you can do."
"I'm not a warlock,"
Tessa protested angrily.
"Well, you're certainly something, my girl," said the older woman. "If not a warlock, then what?"
"That will do," Charlotte drew herself up.
"Miss Gray has already proved her bona fides to me and Mr. Branwell. That will have to be good enough for now, at least until the Enclave makes the decision that they wish to utilize her talents."
"Of course they do,"
said Will. We haven't a hope of succeeding in this plan without her. Gabriel brought his chair forward with such force that the front leg slammed into the stone floor with a cracking noise.
Mrs. Branwell, he said furiously, is William, or is he not, too young to be participating in an enclave meeting?
Charlotte's gaze went from Gabriel's flushed face to Will's expressionless one. She sighed. Yes, he is. Will, Jem, if you'll please wait outside in the corridor with Tessa. Will's expression tightened, but Jem bent a warning look on him, and he remained silent. Gabriel Lightwood looked triumphant.
I will show you out, he announced, springing to his feet.
He ushered the three of them out of the library, then swung out into the corridor after them.
You,
he spat at Will, pitching his voice low so that those in the library couldn't overhear him.
You disgrace the name of Shadowhunters everywhere.
Will leaned against the corridor wall and regarded Gabriel with cool blue eyes. I didn't realize there was much of a name left to disgrace after your father.
I will thank you not to speak of my family, Gabriel snarled, reaching behind himself to pull the library door shut.
How unfortunate that the prospect of your gratitude is not a tempting one, Will said. Gabriel stared at him, his hair disarrayed, his green eyes brilliant with rage. He reminded Tessa of someone in that moment, though she could not have said who.
What?
Gabriel growled.
He means, Jem clarified, that he doesn't care for your thanks.
Gabriel's cheeks darkened to a dull scarlet.
If you weren't underage, Hewendale, it would be monomachia for us, just you and me to the death. I'd chop you into bloody carpet wags.
Stop it, Gabriel, Jem interrupted before Will could reply.
Goading Will into single combat? That's like punishing a dog after you've tormented it into biting you.
You know how he is. Much obliged, James, Will said without taking his eyes off Gabriel. I appreciate the testament to my character. Jem shrugged.
It's the truth.
Gabriel shot Jem a dark glare.
Stay out of this, Carstairs. This doesn't concern you.
Jem moved closer to the door and to Will, who was standing perfectly still, matching Gabriel's cold stare with one of his own. The hairs on the back of Tessa's neck had begun to prickle.
If it concerns Will, it concerns me, Jem said.
Gabriel shook his head.
You're a decent shadow hunter, James, he said, and a gentleman. You have your disability, but no one blames you for that. But this,
he curled his lip, jabbing a finger in Will's direction.
This filth will only drag you down. Find someone else to be your power bate. No one expects Will Hewendale to live past 19, and no one will be sorry to see him go either.
That was too much for Tessa. Without thinking about it, she burst out indignantly.
What a thing to say!
Gabriel, interrupted mid-rant, looked as shocked as if one of the tapestries had suddenly started talking.
Pardon me? You heard me. Telling someone you wouldn't be sorry if they died? It's inexcusable.
She took hold of Will by the sleeve.
Come along, Will. This person obviously isn't worth wasting your time on.
Will looked hugely entertained.
So true.
You...
Gabriel, stammering slightly, looked at Tessa in an alarmed sort of way.
You haven't the slightest idea of the things he's done. And I don't care, either. You're all Nephilim, aren't you? Well, aren't you? You're supposed to be on the same side.
Tessa frowned at Gabriel.
I think you owe Will an apology. I,
said Gabriel,
would rather have my entrails yanked out and tied in a knot in front of my own eyes than apologize to such a worm.
Gracious, said Jem mildly.
You can't mean that.
Not the Will being a worm part, of course. The bit about the entrails, that sounds dreadful.
I do mean it, said Gabriel, warming to his subject. I would rather be dropped into a vat of Malphus venom and left to dissolve slowly until only my bones were left.
Really?
said Will, because I happen to know a chap who could sell us a vat of...
The door of the library opened. Mr. Lightwood stood on the threshold.
Gabriel, he said in a freezing tone, do you plan to attend the meeting, your first enclave meeting, if I must remind you, or would you rather play out here in the corridor with the rest of the children?
No one looked particularly pleased by that comment, especially Gabriel, who swallowed hard, nodded, shot one last glare at Will, and followed his father back into the library, slamming the door shut behind them.
Well,
said Jem after the door had closed behind Gabriel. That was about as bad as I'd expected it would be.
Is this the first time you've seen him since last year's Christmas party?
He asked, addressing the question to Will.
Yes, said Will. Do you think I should have told him I missed him?
No, said Jem.
Is he always like that? Tessa asked. So awful?
You should see his older brother, said Jem. Makes Gabriel look sweeter than gingerbread. Hates Will even more than Gabriel, too, if that's possible.
Will grinned at that, then turned and began making his way down the corridor, whistling as he went. After a moment's hesitation, Jem went after him, gesturing for Tessa to follow.
Why would Gabriel Lightwood hate you, Will? Tessa asked as they went. What did you do to him?
It wasn't anything I did to him,
Will said, stalking along at a rapid pace. It was something I did to his sister. Tessa looked sideways at Jem, who shrugged. Where there's our Will, there's a half dozen angry girls claiming he's compromised their virtue.
Did you?
Tessa asked, hurrying to keep up with the boys. There was simply only so fast you could walk in heavy skirts that swished around your ankles as you went. The delivery of dresses from Bond Street had come the day before, and she was only just beginning to get used to wearing such expensive stuff. She remembered the light dresses she'd worn as a little girl, when she'd been able to run up to her brother, kick him in the ankle, and dart away without him being able to catch her. She wondered briefly what would happen if she tried to do that to Will. She doubted it would work out to her advantage, though the thought had a certain appeal.
Compromise her virtue, I mean.
You have a lot of questions, Will said, veering sharply to the left and up a set of narrow stairs.
Don't you?
I do, Tessa said, the heels of her boots clicking loudly on the stone steps as she followed Will upward. What's Parabate? And what did you mean about Gabriel's father being a disgrace to shadow hunters?
Parabate in Greek is just a term for a soldier paired with a chariot driver, said Jem.
But when Nephilim say it, we mean a matched team of warriors, two men who swear to protect each other and guard each other's backs.
Men, said Tessa. There couldn't be a team of women, or a woman and a man?
I thought you said women didn't have bloodlust, Will said without turning around.
And as for Gabriel's father, let's say that he has something of a reputation for liking demons and downworlders more than he should. I would be surprised if some of the Elder Lightwood's nocturnal visits to certain houses in Shadwell haven't left him with a nasty case of demon pox.
Demon pox?
Tessa was horrified and fascinated at the same time.
He's made that up, Jem hastily reassured her.
Really, Will, how many times do we have to tell you there's no such thing as demon pox?
Will had stopped in front of a narrow door at a bend in the staircase.
I think this is it, he said half to himself and jiggled the knob.
When nothing happened, he took his steely out of his jacket and scrawled a black mark on the door. It swung open with a puff of dust.
This ought to be a storeroom.
Jem followed him inside, and after a moment so did Tessa. She found herself in a small room whose only illumination was from an arched window set high in the wall above. Watery light poured through, showing a square space filled with trunks and boxes. It could have been any spare storage room anywhere if it hadn't been for what looked like piles of old weapons stacked in the corners. Heavy, rusty-looking iron things with broad blades and chains connected to spiked chunks of metal. Will took hold of one of the trunks and moved it sideways to create a clear square of space on the floor. More dust puffed up. Jem coughed and shot him a reproachful look.
"One would think you brought us here to murder us," he said, "if it weren't that your motivations for doing so seem cloudy at best." "Not murder," Will said. "Hold on, I need to move one more trunk." As he pushed the heavy thing toward the wall, Tessa cast a sidelong look at Jem. "What did Gabriel mean?" she asked, pitching her voice too low for Will to hear. "Your disability?" Jem's silvery eyes widened fractionally before he said, "My ill health, that's all." He was lying, Tessa knew. He had the same sort of look Nate did when he lied. A little too clear-eyed a gaze to be a truthful one. But before she could say anything else, Will straightened up and announced, "There we are. Come sit down." He then proceeded to seat himself on the dusty, stained floor. Jem went to sit beside him, but Tessa hung back for a moment, hesitant. Will, who had his steely out, looked up at her with a crooked smile. "Not going to join us, Tessa? I suppose you don't want to ruin the pretty dress Jessamine bought you." It was the truth, actually. Tessa had no desire to wreck the nicest item of clothing she had ever owned, but Will's mocking tone was more annoying than the thought of destroying the dress. Setting her jaw, she went and sat down opposite the boys so that they formed a triangle between them. Will placed the tip of the steely against the dirty floor and began to move it. Broad, dark lines flowed from the tip, and Tessa watched in fascination. There was something particular and beautiful about the way the steely scrolled. Not like ink flowing from a pen, but more as if the lines had always been there, and Will was uncovering them. He was halfway through when Jem made a noise of realization, clearly recognizing the mark that his friend was drawing. "What do you..." he began, but Will held up the hand he wasn't drawing with, shaking his head. "Don't," Will said. "If I make a mess of this, we could well fall through the floor." Jem rolled his eyes, but it didn't seem to matter. Will was already finished and was lifting the steely away from the design he had drawn. Tessa gave a little cry as the warped floorboards between them seemed to shimmer, and then became as transparent as a window. Scooting forward, forgetting entirely about her dress, she found herself staring through it as if through a pane of glass. She was looking down into what she realized was the library. She could see the large round table and the enclave seated at it, Charlotte between Benedict Lightwood and the elegant white-haired woman. Charlotte was easily recognizable, even from above, by the neat nodding of her brown hair and the quick movements of her small hands as she spoke. "Why up here?" Jem asked Will in a low voice. "Why not the weapons room? It's next to the library." "Sound radiates," said Will. "Just as easy to listen from up here. Besides which, who's to say one of them wouldn't decide to pay a visit to the weapons room halfway through the meeting to see what we've in stock? It's happened before." Tessa, staring down in fascination, realized that indeed she could hear the murmur of voices. "Can they hear us?" Will shook his head. "The enchantment is strictly one way." He frowned, leaning forward. "What are they talking about?" The three of them fell silent, and in the quiet the sound of Benedict Lightwood's voice rose clearly to their ears.
"I don't know about this, Charlotte," he said. "This whole plan seems very risky."
"But we cannot simply let De Quincey go on as he has," Charlotte argued. "He's the head vampire of the London clans. The rest of the Night Children look to him for guidance. If we allow him to cavalierly break the law, what message does that send to Downworld? That the Nephilim have grown lax in their guardianship?"
"Just so I understand," Lightwood said, "you're willing to take Lady Belcourt's word that De Quincey, a longtime ally of the Clave, is actually murdering mundanes in his own house?"
"I don't know why you're surprised, Benedict." There was an edge to Charlotte's voice. "Is it your suggestion that we ignore her report, despite the fact that she has given us nothing but reliable information in the past? And despite the fact that if she is once again telling the truth, the blood of everyone that De Quincey murders from this point onward will be on our hands.
and despite the fact that we are bound by the law to investigate any report of the covenant being broken, said a slender, dark-haired man at the far end of the table. You know that as well as the rest of us, Benedict. You're simply being stubborn. Charlotte exhaled as Lightwood's face darkened. Thank you, George. I appreciate that, she said. The tall woman who had earlier called Charlotte Lottie gave a low, rumbling laugh.
Don't be so dramatic, Charlotte, she said. You must admit the whole business is bizarre. A shape-changing girl who may or may not be a warlock, brothels full of dead bodies and an informant who swears he sold De Quincey some machine tools, a fact that you seem to regard as a piece of the most consummate evidence, despite refusing to tell us your informant's name.
I swore I wouldn't involve him, Charlotte protested. He fears De Quincey.
Is he a shadow hunter?
Lightwood demanded.
Because if not, he isn't reliable.
Really, Benedict, your views are most antiquated, said the woman with the cat-like eyes. One might believe, talking to you, that the Accords had never happened. Lillian is correct. You're being ridiculous, Benedict, said George Penhallow. Looking for an entirely reliable informant is like looking for a chaste mistress. If they were virtuous, they would be little use to you in the first place. An informant merely provides information. It is our job to verify that information, which is what Charlotte is suggesting that we do.
I would simply hate to see the powers of the Enclave misused in this instance, Lightwood said in a silky tone.
It was very odd, Tessa thought, hearing this group of elegant adults address one another without honorifics, simply by their first names. But it seemed to be Shadowhunter custom.
If, for instance, there were a vampire who had a grudge against the head of her clan, and perhaps wanted to see him removed from power, what better way than to get the Clave to do her dirty work for her?
Hell, Will muttered, exchanging a glance with Jem. How does he know about that? Jem shook his head as if to say, I don't know. Know about what? Tessa whispered, but her voice was drowned out by Charlotte and the white-haired woman both talking at once.
Camille would never do that, Charlotte protested. She isn't a fool, for one thing. She knows what the punishment for lying to us would be.
Benedict has a point, said the older woman. It would be better if a shadow hunter had seen De Quincey breaking the law.
But that's the point of this whole enterprise, Charlotte said. There was a tinge to her voice of nervousness, a strained desire to prove herself. Tessa felt a flicker of sympathy for her.
To observe De Quincey breaking the law, Aunt Kalida.
Tessa made a startled noise. Jem looked up.
Yes, she's Charlotte's aunt, he said. It was her brother, Charlotte's father, who used to run the Institute. She likes to tell people what to do. Although, of course, she always does whatever she wants.
She does at that, Will agreed.
Did you know she propositioned me once?
Jem did not look as if he believed this, even slightly.
She did not.
She did, Will insisted. It was all very scandalous.
I might have acceded to her demands, too, if she didn't frighten me so much.
Jem simply shook his head and turned his attention back to the scene unfolding in the library.
There's also the matter of De Quincey's seal, Charlotte was saying, which we found inside the body of the clockwork girl. There is simply too much evidence linking him to these events, too much evidence not to investigate.
I agree, said Lillian. I, for one, am concerned about this matter of the clockwork creatures. Making clockwork girls is one thing, but what if he's making a clockwork army?
That's pure speculation, Lillian, said Frederick Ashdown.
Lillian dismissed this with a wave of her hand. An automaton is neither seraph nor demon in its alliance. It is not one of the children of God or of the devil. Would it be vulnerable to our weapons?
I think you're imagining a problem that does not exist, said Benedict Lightwood. There have been automatons for years now. Mundanes are fascinated with the creatures. None has posed a threat to us.
None has been made using magic before, said Charlotte.
That you know of.
Lightwood looked impatient. Charlotte straightened her back. Only Tessa and the others, looking down upon her, could see that her hands were knotted tightly together in her lap. Your concern, Benedict, seems to be that we will unfairly punish De Quincey for a crime he has not committed, and in doing so jeopardize the relationship between the Night Children and the Nephilim. Am I correct? Benedict Lightwood nodded. But all that Will's plan calls for is for us to observe De Quincey. If we do not see him breaking the law, we will not act against him, and the relationship will not be threatened. If we do see him breaking the law, then the relationship is a lie. We cannot allow abuse of covenant law, however convenient it might be for us to ignore.
I agree with Charlotte,
said Gabriel Lightwood, speaking up for the first time, and much to Tessa's surprise.
I think her plan is a sound one, except in one part. Sending the shapeshifter girl in there with Will Herondale. He isn't even old enough to be at this meeting. How can he be trusted with a mission of this gravity?
Smarmy little prig, Will snarled, leaning farther forward, as if he longed to reach through the magical portal and strangle Gabriel. When I get him alone...
I ought to go with her instead, Gabriel went on. I can look out for her a bit more, instead of simply looking out for myself.
Hanging's too good for him, agreed Jem, who looked as if he were trying not to laugh.
Tessa knows Will, protested Charlotte. She trusts Will.
I wouldn't go that far, muttered Tessa.
Besides, Charlotte said, it's Will who devised this plan. Will, who De Quincey will recognize from the Pandemonium Club. It's Will who knows what to search for inside De Quincey's townhouse to tie him to the clockwork creatures and the murdered mundanes. Will's an excellent investigator, Gabriel, and a good shadow hunter. You have to give him that.
Gabriel sat back in his chair, crossing his arms over his chest. I don't have to give him anything.
So Will and your warlock girl enter the house, endure De Quincey's party until they observe some contravention of the law, and then signal to the rest of us.
How? Inquired Lillian.
With Henry's invention, Charlotte said.
There was a slight, only very slight tremble to her voice as she said it.
The phosphor. It will send up a flare of extremely bright witchlight, illuminating all the windows into Quincy's house, just for a moment. That will be the signal.
Oh, good Lord, not one of Henry's inventions again, said George.
There were some complications with the phosphor at first, but Henry demonstrated it for me last night, Charlotte protested. It works perfectly.
Frederick snorted.
Remember the last time Henry offered us the use of one of his inventions? We were all cleaning fish guts off our gear for days.
But it wasn't supposed to be used near water, Charlotte began, still the same quavering voice,
but the others had already begun talking over her, chattering excitedly about Henry's failed inventions and the dreadful consequences thereof, while Charlotte lapsed into silence.
Poor Charlotte, Tessa thought.
Charlotte, whose sense of her own authority was so important and so dearly bought.
Bastards talking over her like that, muttered Will.
Tessa looked at him in astonishment. He was staring intently down at the scene before him, his fists tight at his sides. So he was fond of Charlotte, she thought, and she was surprised how pleased she was to realize it. Perhaps it meant Will actually did have feelings after all.
Not that it had anything to do with her, whether he did or not, of course.
She looked hastily away from Will, at Jem, who seemed equally out of countenance. He was biting his lip. Where is Henry? Shouldn't he have arrived by now? As if in answer, the door to the storage room banged open with a crash, and the three of them spun around to see Henry standing wild-eyed and wild-haired in the doorway. He was clutching something in his hand, the copper tube with the black button on the side that had nearly caused Will to break his arm falling off the sideboard in the dining room.
Will eyed it fearfully.
Get that blasted object away from me.
Henry, who was red-faced and sweating, stared at them all in horror.
Hell, he said. I was looking for the library, the enclave.
Is meeting, said Jem. Yes, we know. It's a flight down from here, Henry. Third door on the right. And you'd better go. Charlotte's waiting for you.
I know, Henry wailed. Blast, blast, blast. I was just trying to get the phosphor right, is all.
Henry, Jem said, Charlotte needs you.
Right.
Henry turned as if to dart out of the room, then swung around and stared at them, a look of confusion passing over his freckled face, as if he had only now had cause to wonder why Will, Tessa, and Jem might be crouching together in a mostly disused storage room.
What are you three doing in here, anyway?
Will tilted his head to the side and smiled at Henry.
Charades, he said. Massive game.
Ah, right then, said Henry, and dashed out the door, letting it swing shut behind him.
Charades, Jem snorted in disgust, then leaned forward again, elbows on his knees, as Kalita's voice drifted up from below.
Honestly, Charlotte, she was saying, when will you admit that Henry hasn't anything to do with running this place, and that you are doing it all by yourself? Perhaps with help from James Carstairs and Will Herondale, but neither of them is any older than 17. How much help can they be?
Charlotte made a murmured noise of deprecation.
It's too much for one person, especially someone your age, said Benedict. You're only 23 years old. If you'd like to step down.
Only 23? Tessa was astonished. She'd thought Charlotte was much older, probably because she exuded such an air of competence. Consul Wayland assigned the running of the Institute to me and my husband 5 years ago, Charlotte replied sharply, apparently having found her voice again. If you have some issue with his choice, you should take it up with him. In the meantime, I shall direct the Institute as I see fit.
I hope that means that plans such as the one you're suggesting are still up for a vote, said Benedict Lightwood. Or are you governing by fiat now?
Don't be ridiculous, Lightwood. Of course it's up for vote, said Lillian crossly without giving Charlotte a chance to answer. All in favor of moving on to Quincy, say aye.
To Tessa's surprise, there was a chorus of ayes, and not a single nay. The discussion had been contentious enough that she'd been certain at least one of the Shadow Hunters would try to back out. Jem caught her startled look and smiled.
They're always like this, he murmured. They like to jockey for power, but none of them would vote no on an issue like this. They'd be branded a coward for doing so.
Very well, said Benedict. Tomorrow night it is, then. Is everyone sufficiently prepared? Are there...
The door to the library banged open, and Henry charged in, looking, if possible, even more wild-eyed and wild-haired than before.
I'm here, he announced. Not too late, am I?
Charlotte covered her face with her hands.
Henry, said Benedict Lightwood dryly, how pleasant to see you. Your wife was just briefing us on your newest invention. The phosphor, is it?
Yes!
Henry held the phosphor up proudly.
This is it, and I can promise it works as advertised. See?
Now there's no need for a demonstration,
Benedict began hastily, but it was too late. Henry had already pressed the button. There was a bright flash, and the lights in the library winked out suddenly, leaving Tessa staring at an unlit black square in the floor. Gasps rose up from below. There was a shriek, and something crashed to the ground and shattered. Rising above it all was the sound of Benedict Lightwood swearing fluently. Will looked up and grinned.
Bit awkward for Henry, of course, he remarked cheerfully.
And yet, somehow quite satisfying, don't you think?
Tessa couldn't help but agree on both counts. 10. Pale Kings and Princes. I saw pale kings and princes, too.
Pale warriors, death pale were they all. John Keats, La Belle Dame sans Merci. As the coach rattled along the strand, Will raised a black-gloved hand and drew one of the velvet curtains back from the window, letting a splash of yellow gaslight find its way into the carriage's dark interior.
"It rather looks," he said, "as if we might be in for rain tonight."
Tessa followed his gaze. Out the window the sky was a cloudy, steel gray. The usual for London, she thought. Men in hats and long dark coats hurried along the pavement on either side of the street, their shoulders hunched against a brisk wind that carried coal dust, horse manure, and all sorts of eye-stinging rubbish in its wake. Once again, Tessa thought she could smell the river.
"Is that a church directly in the middle of the street?" she wondered aloud.
"It's St. Mary Lestrand," said Will, "and there's a long story about it, but I'm not going to tell it to you now. Have you been listening to anything I've been saying?"
"I was," Tessa said, "until you started on about rain."
"Who cares about rain? We're on our way to some sort of vampire society event, and I've no idea how I'm supposed to behave, and so far you haven't helped me much at all." The corner of Will's mouth twitched upward.
"Just be careful. When we arrive at the house, you can't look to me for help or instruction. Remember, I'm your human subjugate. You keep me about you for blood. Blood whenever you want it, and nothing else."
"So you're not going to speak tonight," Tessa said, "at all."
"Not unless you instruct me to," said Will.
"This evening sounds as if it might be better than I thought." Will seemed not to have heard her. With his right hand, he was tightening one of the metal knife-bearing cuffs on his left wrist. He was staring off toward the window as if seeing something that wasn't visible to her.
"You might be thinking of vampires as feral monsters, but these vampires are not like that. They are as cultured as they are cruel, sharpened knives to humanity's dull blade." The line of his jaw was set hard in the dim light.
"You will have to try to keep up. And for God's sake, if you can't, don't say anything at all. They have a torturous and opaque sense of etiquette. A serious social gaffe could mean instant death."
Tessa's hands tightened on each other in her lap. They were cold. She could feel the cold of Camille's skin, even through her gloves.
"Are you joking? The way you were in the library about dropping that book?"
"No." His voice was remote.
"Well, you're frightening me." The words came out of Tessa's mouth before she could stop them. She tensed, expecting mockery. Will drew his gaze away from the window and looked at her as if some realization had dawned on him.
"Tess," he said, and Tessa felt a momentary jolt. No one had ever called her Tess.
Sometimes her brother had called her Tessie, but that was all.
"You know you don't have to do this if you don't want to."
She took a breath, one she didn't need.
"And then what? We would turn the carriage around and go home?"
He put his hands out and took hers. Camille's hands were so small that Will's capable, dark-gloved ones seemed to swallow them up.
"One for all and all for one," he said.
She smiled at that, weakly. "The Three Musketeers?" His steady gaze held hers. His blue eyes were very dark, uniquely so. She had known people before with blue eyes, but they had always been light blue. Will's were the color of the sky just on the edge of night. His long lashes veiled them as he said,
"Sometimes when I have to do something I don't want to do, I pretend I'm a character from a book. It's easier to know what they would do."
"Really? Who do you pretend you are?"
"D'Artagnan," Tessa asked, naming the only one of the Three Musketeers that she could remember.
"It is a far, far better thing that I do than I have ever done," Will quoted. "It is a far, far better rest that I go to than I have ever known."
"Sidney Carton? But you said you hated A Tale of Two Cities."
"I don't really." Will seemed unabashed by his lie.
"And Sidney Carton was a dissipated alcoholic."
"Exactly. There was a man who was worthless and knew he was worthless, and yet however far down he tried to sink his soul, there was always some part of him capable of great action. Will lowered his voice. What is it he says to Lucy Manette? That though he is weak, he can still burn? Tessa, who had read A Tale of Two Cities more times than she could count, whispered, And yet I have had the weakness, and have still the weakness, to wish you to know with what a sudden mastery you kindled me, heap of ashes that I am, into fire. She hesitated. But that was because he loved her. Yes, said Will. He loved her enough to know she was better off without him. His hands were still on hers, the heat of them burning through her gloves. The wind was brisk outside and had ruffled his ink-black hair as they had crossed the Institute courtyard to the carriage. It made him look younger and more vulnerable. And his eyes, too, were vulnerable, open like a door. The way he was looking at her, she would not have thought Will could or would look at anyone like that. If she could blush, she thought, how she would be blushing now. And then she wished she had not thought of that, for that thought led inevitably and unpleasantly to another. Was he looking at her now, or at Camille, who was indeed exquisitely beautiful? Was that the reason for his change in expression? Could he see Tessa through the disguise, or only the shell of her? She drew back, taking her hands from his, though his were closed tightly around hers. It took a moment to disengage them. Tessa, he began, but before he could say more, the carriage came to a jerking stop that set the velvet curtains swaying. Thomas called, We're here, from the driver's seat. Will, after taking a deep breath, swung the door open and leapt down to the pavement, lifting his hand to help her down after him. Tessa bent her head as she exited the carriage to avoid crushing any of the roses on Camille's hat. Though Will wore gloves, as she did, she could almost imagine she felt the pulsing of blood under his skin, even through the double layer of fabric that separated them. He was flushed, the color high in his cheeks, and she wondered if it was the cold whipping the blood into his face, or something else. They were standing in front of a tall, white house with a white pillared entrance. It was surrounded by similar houses on either side, like rows of pale dominoes. Up a row of white steps was a pair of double doors painted black. They were ajar, and Tessa could see the glimmer of candlelight from within, shimmering like a curtain. Tessa turned to look at Will. Behind him, Thomas was seated at the front of the carriage, his hat tipped forward to hide his face. The silver-handled pistol tucked into his waistcoat pocket was entirely hidden from view. Somewhere in the back of her head she felt Camille laugh, and she knew, without knowing how she knew, that she was sensing the vampire woman's amusement at her admiration of Will. There you are, Tessa thought, relieved despite her annoyance. She had begun to fear that Camille's inner voice would never come to her. She drew away from Will, lifting her chin. The haughty pose wasn't natural to her, but it was to Camille. You will address me not as Tessa, but as a servant would, she said, her lip curling. Now come. She jerked her head imperiously toward the steps and started off without looking back to see if he followed. An elegantly dressed footman awaited her at the top of the steps. Your ladyship, he murmured, and as he bowed, Tessa saw the two fang punctures in his neck just above the collar. She turned her head to see Will behind her and was about to introduce him to the footman when Camille's voice whispered in the back of her head, We do not introduce our human pets to each other. They are our nameless property, unless we choose to give them names. Ugh, Tessa thought. In her disgust, she hardly noticed as the footman guided her down a long corridor and into a large marble-floored room. He bowed again and departed. Will moved to her side, and for a moment they both stood, staring. The space was lit only by candles, Dozens of gold candelabras dotted the room, fat white candles blazing in the holders. Hands carved of marble reached from the walls, each gripping a scarlet candle, drips of red wax blooming like roses along the sides of the carved marble. And among the candelabras moved vampires, their faces as white as clouds, their movements graceful and liquid and strange. Tessa could see their similarities to Camille, the features they shared, the poreless skin, the jewel-colored eyes, the pale cheeks splotched with artificial rouge. Some looked more human than others. Many were dressed in the fashions of bygone ages, knee breeches and cravats, skirts as full as Marie Antoinette's or gathered into trains at the back, lace cuffs and linen frills. Tessa's gaze scanned the room frantically, searching for a familiar, fair-haired figure, but Nathaniel was nowhere to be seen. Instead, she found herself trying not to stare at a tall, skeletal woman dressed in the heavily wigged and powdered fashion of 100 years ago. Her face was stark and dreadful, whiter than the white powder dusting her hair. Her name was Lady Delilah, Camille's voice whispered in Tessa's mind. Lady Delilah held a slight figure by the hand, and Tessa's mind recoiled. A child in this place? But when the figure turned, she saw that it was a vampire as well, sunken dark eyes like pits in its rounded, childish face. It smiled at Tessa, showing bared fangs. "We must look for Magnus Bane," Will said under his breath. "He is meant to guide us through this mess. I shall point him out if I see him." She was about to tell Will that Camille would recognize Magnus for her when she caught sight of a slender man with a shock of fair hair, wearing a black swallowtail coat. Tessa felt her heart leap, and then fall in bitter disappointment as he turned. It was not Nathaniel. This man was a vampire with a pale, angular face. His hair was not yellow like Nate's, but was almost colorless under the candlelight. He dropped Tessa a wink and began to move toward her, pushing through the crowd. There were not only vampires among them, Tessa saw, but human subjugates as well. They carried gleaming serving trays, and on the trays were sets of empty glasses. Beside the glasses lay an array of silver utensils, all sharp-pointed. Knives, of course, and thin tools like the awls shoemakers used to punch holes in leather. As Tessa stared in confusion, one of the subjugates was stopped by the woman in the white powdered wig. She snapped her fingers imperiously, and the darkling, a pale boy in a gray jacket and trousers, turned his head to the side obediently. After plucking a thin awl from the tray with her skinny fingers, the vampire drew the sharp tip across the skin of the boy's throat just below his jaw. The glasses rattled on the tray as his hand shook, but he didn't drop the tray, not even when the woman lifted a glass and pressed it against his throat so that the blood ran down into it in a thin stream. Tessa's stomach tightened with a sudden mixture of revulsion and hunger. She could not deny the hunger, even though it belonged to Camille and not her. Stronger than the thirst, though, was her horror. She watched as the vampire woman lifted the glass to her lips, the human boy beside her standing gray-faced and trembling as she drank. She wanted to reach for Will's hand, but a vampire baroness would never hold the hand of her human subjugate. She straightened her spine and beckoned Will to her side with a quick snap of her fingers. He looked up in surprise, then moved to join her, clearly fighting to hide his annoyance. But hide it he must.
"Now don't go wandering off, William," she said with a meaningful glance. "I don't want to lose you in the crowd." Will's jaw set. "I'm getting the oddest feeling that you're enjoying this," he said under his breath.
"Nothing odd about it."
Feeling unbelievably bold, Tessa chucked him under the chin with the tip of her lace fan.
"Simply behave yourself." "They are so hard to train, aren't they?"
The man with the colorless hair emerged out of the crowd, inclining his head toward Tessa.
"Human subjugates, that is. he added, mistaking her startled expression for confusion. And then, once you have them properly trained, they die of something or other. Delicate creatures.